Welcome to Orphan Radio. This is Matt. I'm in Charlotte, North Carolina, and my guest today is author TJ English. He's in New York City, and we're going to talk about his new book, Dangerous Rhythms, Jazz in the Underworld, that just came out this week. This is his fourth time on the podcast, so welcome back.
Oh, great to be here.
I read the book. You sent me a copy about a month ago, and I got to read the whole thing. And this whole story starts in a place in New Orleans called Storyville. Can you talk a little bit about how all these different forces collided in that little neighborhood in New Orleans there and how this whole story started?
Yeah. Storyville was a district that was created by the city government as a way to round up and control all vice in the city of New Orleans and locate it in one specific area. It was a concept that was not uncommon in the United States in the late 19th century. There was prostitution and there was gambling and there were other forms of vice, and people were concerned about it. It existed all around in the cities like New Orleans that were teeming with an immigrant class. And there was always discussions about what to do about this. The city forefathers didn't want to eradicate it completely because there was money to be made there. Gambling, prostitution, and other forms of vice were generating money. And so the thinking was, how do we control this? How do we focus this in such a way that it doesn't harm the little boys and girls living in the city, but makes it possible for adults who want to indulge in this kind of activity to be able to do so? So this idea of vice districts, the vice district in the city, was quite common. It existed in New Orleans and in Kansas City and a lot of the frontier towns in the United States, who felt it was important to give an outlet to men, mostly. Let's be frank, it was mostly men who entered into these districts for gambling and prostitution. And the idea was give them an opportunity to let off steam and indulge in a little harmless vice in a way that might even benefit the founding fathers of the city, because a lot of these vice districts paid a tax, an official or unofficial tax, to city government. So the money flowed. And in fact, a lot of the money from these vice districts was used to build the city at large. In New Orleans, of course, this was especially legendary, because New Orleans was such a unique environment, its mixture of Spanish and French and American origins. And so it had these traditions, like its tradition of bordellos and prostitution, which came from France, was kind of grandiose compared to the rest of the United States. And so Storyville was created by the city fathers and became the central vice district. And it's where jazz was born. I mean, jazz was born, the origins of jazz come from a lot of different sources, but Storyville was one of the first places where jazz was presented. It was presented in the honky tonks and the dance halls and what would later be called nightclubs in Storyville. And it's kind of a legendary for the role that it played in the origins of jazz. Jazz music came up from the plantations and from the streets and just took the city and the nation by storm. And so Storyville became the central locale for presenting the music. And this is what brought it into direct contact with mobsters. The earliest form of the mafia in the United States began in New Orleans, because there was a large wave of Sicilian immigrants into New Orleans starting in the late 19th century and into the early 20th century. And so jazz and the beginnings of the mob began at the same time, more or less, just a quirk of history that brought all these elements together.
Yeah. You kind of present this story in the context, you talk a lot about lynching and the everyday threat of violence that African-American people faced when the whole jazz movement kicks off. Can you talk about that a little bit and how that kind of played into how it kind of developed?
Yeah, this is a very important point, I think. And it came to me when I was burrowing deep into this subject. There were a couple questions that were preeminent on my mind. One of them was, how did jazz, why did jazz happen? Jazz, it's hard for us to acknowledge it or see it now, but jazz was a revolutionary act. It was incredible what jazz was and how it came about. It was an effort on the descendants of slaves to create a whole new musical language, a whole new musical reality, in a sense. And I would read the books on jazz history and the origins of jazz, and they were all somewhat unsatisfying. They didn't really explain it. I mean, they laid out all the factual details, but spiritually, I was wondering, why did jazz come into being and how did it come into being? Why was it this unprecedented expression of life through the music, totally unique in the way it formulated? And so that led me to the reality of lynching, that in the years before jazz was born, in the early years of the 20th century, there had been a 30-year reign of terror in the United States in the form of lynching, most of it in the South, but with reverberations all around the United States, and that African Americans existed in this reality. Many were born into this reality, living in a menacing, hostile environment. And then comes jazz. So it seemed quite possible to me, it's a theory, I can't prove this, of course, but it seemed quite possible to me that jazz was a response to that. And it explains something else that was preeminent on my mind when I began this book, was why did the musicians formulate this relationship with underworld figures, with gangsters? Most people burrow into this subject and they think, well, that it's a moral shortcoming that the musicians would partner with gangsters. Well, the truth is, given the lay of the land in the United States at that time, particularly in the South, and we are talking about Louisiana, where there was more lynching than anywhere else in the United States for a long period of time, African-American musicians, as they began to bend their mind around the concept that they could make a living through the performance of this music, and that this music might actually be a point of entree into American society, unlike anything most African-Americans had ever experienced before, that was a frightening concept for some. You were venturing beyond the ghetto and you were entering into the American marketplace. And this was a quite possibly a perilous path for African-Americans. They would be playing in clubs that were predominantly patronized by whites. And they needed protection. They needed a sense of brotherhood with a power structure to bring them into this world. And so partnering with the mob and with the underworld figures was almost a natural step. I illustrate this, of course, through the example of Louis Armstrong, who's the first great and greatest jazz star to emerge. Louis Armstrong was very clear about realizing that if he was going to function within a world of clubs and a music business that was all mobbed up and controlled by hoodlums, gangsters, then he would get for him the biggest gangster of them all as a protector, which he did through his choice of manager, and also through the fact that he preferred to play in clubs that were mobbed up, because those clubs had a reputation for being safer and for paying the musicians on time, and generally better working conditions that they found in the clubs that weren't mobbed up. Mm-hmm. So if you look at it that way, you start to see how natural and logical it was that this relationship began.
Yeah. And you use the term, you say it as it develops and kind of I think you say that jazz spreads or goes up river from New Orleans to other cities in the U.S. But you also say that it kind of turned into a business model that you call a plantation style business model. Will you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, it's fascinating how the early jazz clubs are all built around the aesthetic of the antebellum South, the cotton club, the plantation club. There were cotton clubs and plantation clubs in three or four different cities. Something about the beginnings of jazz got all wrapped up in the concept of servitude and Southern gentry, and these clubs reflected that, and it did foster a plantation mentality that existed at every level of the business. And it was that way for quite a while. It was even kind of an anachronism. You still had plantation club in St. Louis right up until the 1940s. And if you see the menus from those kind of clubs, they all have black sambos on the front. Very, very offensive stuff. Jazz got wrapped up in that. It became part of the presentation of jazz. But even beyond the aesthetic aspects of it, the business as a business model, the idea of the plantation, the clubs that were owned and operated by white people, in this case, mostly the immigrant class, Italians and Jews and Irish, and the workers were predominantly African-American musicians. And this was the model that held for a long time, really up until the 1960s in the civil rights movement. This was kind of the model that existed for the business. It was a plantation mentality.
Yeah. I don't know if you know the answer to this, but if these guys were out on tour, like say before the 1960s, would they play a club that wasn't affiliated with the mob in some way, if they had to just make money, in between shows or something? And how did that work? Like if they, you know, were there ever issues around that?
Yeah, that's kind of interesting because later in the 1930s, 40s and 50s, after the Prohibition era, the mob kind of used jazz and jazz clubs as a way to franchise around the United States. And this is above and beyond the cities we all think of as jazz centers of jazz: New York, Chicago, Kansas City, New Orleans. I'm talking about cities like Pittsburgh, Detroit, Denver, Colorado, San Francisco. Jazz clubs would pop up in these cities and they were inevitably owned or controlled by some local mobster element, you know, either the local mob boss in that city or the mob boss from the nearest big city that held sway in that town. And this was the model in not just big cities, but mid-sized cities all over the United States. And so certain acts, certain musicians, bands that had been associated with mob clubs in the 1920s, let's say the Duke Ellington Orchestra, Cab Calloway, Nat King Cole later, these were all musicians who got their starts in clubs that were associated with the mob. I think it was kind of understood that as they branched out to play and go on tour and play in other cities, that they would play in mob clubs. And this is how they became friendly with the mob. And they operated within the embrace of the mob. So that in later decades, when Las Vegas is born, for instance, the early bookings in Las Vegas are all these musicians who were considered to be mob friendly, who had played in mob clubs going all the way back to the 1920s. So it was kind of understood as a business arrangement that he's one of ours, that they're one of ours, that they play for us, that we take care of them. And if you were someone that bucked the system and chose to not play in mob controlled clubs, and some musicians did, you would be persona non grata. And so in a lot of these places in Vegas, and by the time Vegas comes into being in the late 50s and in the 60s, jazz has started to die out as the popular musical art form that it was for decades. It starts to die out. And so the entertainers and musicians who get booked in Vegas are considered very lucky. You're getting bookings in Las Vegas where they book you for a week, or sometimes even a couple weeks, a residency at one of the clubs in one of the casinos. That was great for the livelihood of the musicians. And they were being rewarded, in a sense, for having been affiliated with the mob clubs going all the way back to the glory years of 1920s.
Mm-hmm. there's a lot of very famous people in this story, like Frank Sinatra, Bing Crosby, all the big mob bosses that we've heard about for years. But one I wanted to ask you in particular about, if you could talk about his role in it, was Al Capone's relationship with jazz.
Yeah, more than any other gangster, Capone loved the music and was a patron of the music. He also loved opera, by the way. I kind of think of it as opera representing his Italian side and jazz representing his American side. He loved jazz. He owned a piece of four or five different clubs in Chicago, some of the most prominent clubs in Chicago. And he was a presence in these clubs. You know, he would come to these places to listen to the music. There's a club in Chicago. Those of you who know Chicago, there's a club uptown called Green Mill. Green Mill opened in 1908, and it was a mob-controlled club back in the 20s. Still exists to this day. Looks pretty much the same as it looked back in the 1920s. Amazing place. If you're ever in Chicago and you want to breathe in the atmosphere of this story, go to Green Mill. He owned these clubs, loved the music. In fact, I'll tell you a famous anecdote about Capone and Fats Waller, who was an entertainer that he adored. Fats Waller was from Harlem in New York, but he was popular enough that he could go to Kansas City and Chicago and other big jazz towns, and he would draw a following. Fats Waller, by the way, for anyone who doesn't know, go online and seek out his music. He was a phenomenal entertainer. His presentation style was filled with joy. Just a singular figure in the history of the music. It's totally understandable why Capone was enthralled by him. He saw Waller for the first time at a club in Chicago somewhere around 1925 or 26, I think it was, when he first saw Waller, and he just loved him. And a few nights later, a couple of Capone's underlings came into that club, and at gunpoint, they told Waller that when he finished his set, they were going to take him to a hotel in Cicero, suburb of Chicago, which was kind of the base of Capone's operation, and that he was going to perform at a birthday party that would stretch over the weekend in Cicero, a birthday party for Capone. It was a surprise that Waller would be there. And of course, Waller was terrified by this, taken out of the club at gunpoint. And he didn't have any choice in the matter. They took him to the hotel in Cicero, put him up in a nice room and said, this is where you're going to be for the next 2 or 3 days. And while you're going to be brought to perform at the party, which is what transpired. And Capone was thrilled by it. And Fats Waller was lavished with cash over the course of this weekend. He claims to have left Chicago with $3,000 in cash in his pocket, which in today's money would probably be somewhere around $30,000 at least. And he had a great story to tell for the rest of his life. That's sort of a lighthearted version of the jazz gangster relationship story. There are other stories that are not nearly as benign as that.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I like about all the books you've written is you really immerse yourself in whatever you're going to write about. And I wanted to ask about the research for this book. How was this research process different from stuff you've written in the past?
Yeah, interesting question, because COVID happened in the middle of this research and dictated certain things. In a lot of ways, this was a subject that I had been thinking about writing about for my entire adult life, ever since I fell in love with the music of jazz when I was a teenager and started to take in the lore and history of jazz. And this was a subject that would pop up in jazz histories, certain biographies of specific musicians, they would mention it. I knew there was a great story here that no one had really taken the time to sort of burrow into it and find the narrative, the historical narrative from its beginnings all the way up to its logical conclusion. And I had been thinking about this book. It was sort of in my back pocket for a long time. So in some ways you could say I I had been doing research for years and years and years just by absorbing the music and learning about the music and seeing its connections to the crime world. It was a couple years ago when I decided it was time to do this book, and I began the research. I made a couple research trips, one to New Orleans and one to Kansas City. And then COVID happened, and it made it impossible for a while to travel to these places and do research. And I was really worried about that. I was lucky in the sense that the cities I had been planning to go to, Chicago, Las Vegas, Los Angeles, and do some research, were cities that I knew well. I went to college in LA, and I knew these cities, and I had done some jazz research in these cities already. So it wasn't absolutely essential that I physically needed to go there. But all of a sudden, all the research was sort of centered online. And I learned a lot of things that I didn't know, which is a lot of the historical archives and museums now they have everything online. You can access everything from these institutions that they have online, more or less. I mean, you have to navigate it and learn how to do that, but it is there. So it was a glorious thing to have this subject during the COVID period, because everything had shut down and I was able to focus on online research. And it was kind of wonderful because the research involved jazz. And so just playing jazz, listening to jazz, entering into the spiritual world of Louis Armstrong and Duke Ellington and all these wonderful characters, it was kind of my salvation during the dark days of COVID to be able to have this subject matter to research and write.
Mm-hmm. One of your previous books, Patty Whacked, you have a section on Kansas City in there too. So did you go to Kansas City to do research for that too when you wrote that book?
I did, yes, I did. I did research in Kansas City, but I didn't go to the 18th and Vine District. It was the jazz district. They have a great jazz museum now in that area. It was one of the most fertile and famous neighborhoods for the beginning of jazz in the 20s and on into the 30s. I've mentioned these vice districts. That was a classic example of the melding of illegal alcohol, gambling, prostitution, and jazz. Robert Altman made a movie about it called Kansas City. It's not a great movie, but the music is great. A lot of attention was placed on the authenticity of the music. So I highly recommend that aspect of it to people. Going to 18th and Vine was wonderful to be able to do that. When you do research for these historical books, you know, some of the books I do are contemporary subjects and some are historical. When you do one of these books that's mostly historical and the characters are dead and gone, and you're not doing firsthand interviews with people, you're seeking to find ways to access this history. And there's nothing as valuable as going to a place like the 18th and Vine District in Kansas City or almost anywhere in New Orleans and standing on a street corner where a lot of these events took place and to breathe in the atmosphere of that area. I'm telling you, man, you feel the ghosts, you feel the spirits when you're that tied in and you're that attuned to what it is you're researching. You can go physically to those places and you can feel the ghosts and the spirits of that era. Certainly true in that part of Kansas City, because that era, I mean, you do even a little bit of research on jazz and you start to read about that era and you realize, wow, what a fertile, what a spectacular era in the development of the music and also just the underworld history. I mean, Kansas City was run by the Pendergast machine, an Irish-American political machine that ran Kansas City, controlled Kansas City. T.J. Pendergast was the boss. He was the guy that made the good times roll. He had tremendous political power. He basically handpicked the political structure in that town, and he allowed the vice districts to operate as long as they delivered votes to him and his candidates and his machine on election day. That's how it worked. That's how it worked in Kansas City and many big cities across the United States.
Mm-hmm. One thing I forgot to ask you about real quick is Prohibition kind of pushed this whole thing into overdrive in cities across the whole country. The kind of the linking up of the music, the alcohol, and the vice districts, like you were talking about.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's kind of well documented in books and movies and popular culture, the Jazz Age, when, you know, the role that it played in the formation of the American underworld, certainly. But, you know, it also was an incredibly fertile period for the music because, you know, in any speakeasy, there was usually a small band playing, a trio, a quartet. You couldn't really have a speakeasy unless you had a little jazz band in there. It was almost required. And then the larger clubs in Kansas City, there was a club called the Cuban Gardens. It was owned by Johnny Lazia, who was the preeminent mafiosi in Kansas City. You'd have a big orchestra with 30 or 40 people in the band. And it was really only the mob clubs that could afford to do that because from the very beginning, starting in Prohibition, and this was interesting to me, I guess I didn't fully realize this, the clubs were used as by the mobsters as fronts for their criminal operations. So a lot of the illegal money that was being generated through the distribution of alcohol was funneled back into the nightclubs and other businesses as a way of laundering money. And so jazz clubs were not burdened with the responsibility of turning a profit because a lot of them were just fronts for the criminal organizations. And this was great for jazz. It sustained the clubs even beyond the 1920s, you know, when jazz started to wane as a popular form of music. The clubs still existed because the clubs were still being used as fronts and laundering operations.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that was the biggest surprise thing that you didn't realize before you went into all the research that you learned?
That was one. There were a lot of things that I did. I, you know, one of the great joys of doing this kind of work is you can take a subject and I always start with a subject that I think I know a lot about already. It's part of how I choose what I'm going to write about. I find something that I feel like I've been immersed in for a long time, for years. And then you get in there and you learn a lot of stuff you didn't know, especially if it's sort of uncharted territory, as this subject was in a way. Nobody had written this book before. Maybe this book should have been written. I kind of wish it had been written decades ago when some of the musicians that I'm writing about were still alive and I could have interviewed them firsthand about it. But most were dead and gone. And like some of the other books, like Havana Nocturne, where I was writing about the era of the mob in Havana in the 1950s, it was a great subject just sitting there waiting to be written about. And so as you start to burrow into it, you make all these really incredible discoveries, things that you didn't know at all. And that's kind of exciting and inspirational.
Mm-hmm. What are you going to work on next? Do you already have a subject in mind for what your next book is going to be about, or are you still kind of sorting that out?
No, I'm well into it. I already have a publisher and I'm into the writing of it. This is how you know you're into it. I'm already behind schedule. It's a book called The Last Kilo. It's about the cocaine era of the 1980s, primarily in Miami. And the guys who controlled that, who basically pioneered and created the system of cocaine importation and distribution in the United States. It was a couple of Cubans named Willie Falcone and Sal Magluta. And I'm working with Willie Falcone, who served 26 years in prison and got out a few years ago and wants to tell his story. So I'm hoping it will be kind of the definitive cocaine era book.
Well, it was good to talk to you again. And I appreciate you doing this.
Sure. Anytime, Matt.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Take care of yourself.
Thank you.